This lecture is about one of the most interesting of all the philosophers, and arguably the greatest of the English philosophers, not the greatest British philosopher. I think that accolade must go to David Hume, the Scot. But among the English philosophers, I don't think there's anybody who has made a greater contribution to human thought in certain areas than Thomas Hobbes, spelt with a E between the two B's and the S. He lived a long life. His dates, in fact, were 1588 to 1679. He died in his 91st year. And he lived during the time of the Charleses, Charles I and Charles II, and, of course, during the time of the Civil War. He was, in fact, tutor to Charles I's children, and then when Cromwell and the Commonwealth took over, he had to get out of the country. In fact, he was under sentence of death because of his affiliation with the royalist cause, and he had to leave the country, went to France and to Holland for a while. And then at the Restoration, when Charles II came back as king, Hobbes returned and became then tutor to Charles II's children. So his life was very much spent in public affairs, and in fact he was very well known in London. He was actually born in Malmesbury in Wiltshire, but he became quite a well-known figure in London because, apart from anything else, he was a very tall man, much above the average height, and his being with monarchy in the way he was got him well known in all the official circles. And apart from all that, as a matter of fact, he was a very nice man. Charles II described Thomas Hobbes as his performing bear. If you see a picture of him, he has an extremely benign face. I've always thought of him as the face of everybody's favourite uncle. Well, now, his teaching falls into two categories, though as far as his thinking was concerned, he saw these two categories as absolutely integrally locked. It begins with his view on human nature, which was, to put it very mildly, pessimistic. He believed that we are basically selfish, that everything we do is motivated by self-interest. He did not accept that there was such a quality as altruism. Of course, he accepted that people perform deeds that others could well and do describe as altruistic. People give up their work to go, for example, to work perhaps among poor and poverty-stricken people in another community or overseas. People make great sacrifices of their time and money on other people's behalf. But Hobbes would have argued and did argue that they did this because they got a great satisfaction, a sense of fulfillment, even a sense of doing their duty to God by acting in this way. He argued that the person who, in the name or following, as they describe it, a call from God, that if they didn't obey this call, they would feel that somehow or other their eternal destinies were challenged, and therefore they were doing this in order to ensure, if you like, a place in heaven. This is, of course, an intense approach, and one might well say that there are such things as altruistic deeds where the person has no such consideration. But Hobbes argued that deep down we are all of us motivated by self-interest. And had he lived a century or more later, during the time of the birth of the evolution theory, which states that the basic drive is to survive, Hobbes would have been very much in line with that teaching, that none of us can avoid this basic drive, and that none of us can avoid, therefore, in the end, being selfish. In fact, he describes the natural condition of human beings, the natural condition of man, he said, is a state of war against everyone. And he described life in a very famous sentence as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, despite his nearly 91 years. But that's how he described it. It's a very famous phrase. Solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Now, you may argue that, in fact, you do not feel in a state of war with everybody else. That, in fact, that you get on perfectly well with your colleagues at work or your neighbours at home, and that, although you might have the occasional niggle, on the whole, there's a fairly cordial relationship established between you. Well, I don't think Hobbes would have gone out of his way to deny that. All he would have said was that that is fine so long as nothing that you need comes under threat. But when there is a short supply of certain any commodity, then things change. And we know this very well, that if there is a short supply, how queues form to buy that item which is in short supply. And the items are bought not for the good of the community as a whole, but to make sure that this one particular individual or that individual's family is catered for, never mind the rest. Recently, as I'm giving this lecture, there was the pressure put at the petrol stations by certain people who were complaining about the price of petrol. And if you were involved in that, you'll recall how you had to queue, often for great periods of time, in order to get it. And there was one occasion where somebody on a local Welsh radio just let out that he'd heard a rumour. This was after it all been come back to normal. He'd heard a rumour that these pickets were going to come into place again and prevent the petrol being sold. And I know that in my local petrol station, the queue, even on the basis of a rumour on a local radio, which was immediately scotched, incidentally, and it was announced by those who had led the former picketing that this was not the case. Despite that, there was a queue. Well, I could see for 3/4 of a mile, and the queue went on beyond that. So it just shows that once we're threatened with something that is an essential commodity, it seems that what Thomas Hobbes says is confirmed, that immediately we say, whatever happens to anybody else, I must make sure that I'm all right. And I remember a time some years ago when there was a bread shortage, and my secretary asked me one morning if I minded if she went out for a few minutes, which I didn't, and she came back, she said, have a look at this, and took me outside the office we were in, and there outside was her car, and she opened the car, and the car was absolutely full. I've never seen anything like it in my life, actually. It was absolutely full of loaves of bread. The passenger seat was packed, the whole of the back seat, and she lifted up the boot and showed that that too was packed in loaves of bread. She must have had 100 loaves there stuck into the car. And she just looked me straight in the eyes and said, my family is not going to starve. Well, one feels like saying, well, Madame Defarge, let them eat cake. The point is that Hobbes would have said, what else do you expect? That where there's a threat to what is our basic food, I suppose, bread, then this mother is going to make sure that her family doesn't go without. The fact that by buying all those loaves meant that other families would have to go without didn't seem to concern her in the slightest. And Hobbes would have said, that is precisely how human beings are. Well, they say we're not all like that, and in any case, if there's one loaf between two, the probability is we'll agree that half a loaf is better than none. In other words, we learn to compromise. Hobbes would argue that even compromise is done out of self-interest. That you've got a situation where there's one loaf, and there's two people after this one loaf. Each would be thinking, well, if we fight for it, I might win and get the loaf, but on the other hand, this other person might win. So I would have none. And so, because they're frightened of having none, rather than sacrificing the thought of having the whole loaf. Compromise is made. Compromise out of self-interest. And Hobbes was quite unmoved about this, with people who argued with him, religious people argued with him, that we are made to love one another, and that takes over. His argument is very simple, that if we do show consideration for others, it's because it's in our interest to show consideration for others. There's a famous example of an occasion when Hobbes was coming down the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral, and on one of the steps sat a beggar with his hat in front of him, and Hobbes put some coins in the beggar's hat. And it happened that the Dean of St. Paul's was coming past just at that moment, and he said to Thomas Hobbes, Dr. Hobbes, he said, if it were not for the example of our Lord, would you have put that money in that poor man's hat? And Hobbes' reply was typical Hobbes. He said, I gave the beggar that money because I enjoyed giving it and he enjoyed receiving it. My comment on that is Thomas Hobbes 3, Dean of St. Paul's, nil. However, you may say, well, surely there are examples, famous examples of altruism. What about the sacrifice of Captain Oates at the South Pole? There he was in this tent with three of his companions, Scott and Bowers and Wilson, and no, he was ill, no hope of moving while he was ill, and their only hope of being saved, of surviving, was to get to the base camp where the provisions were, and they were waiting for him to recover. And he made the great gesture, a famous statement, I'm going out, I may be some time, and was never seen again, of course. He was lost in the blizzard. It is difficult, I suppose, to say other than that was a genuine sacrifice, except that it could well be that Oates considered he was going to die anyway. In fact, we now have Scott's journal. It shows that he didn't expect that any of them would survive, and that he might as well make this gesture. We can speculate about that. Hobbes would certainly have said that there were other reasons than pure altruism for performing, acting as he did. That's Hobbes's view. Before we go on to see how he applied this point of view, I ought to state that other philosophers have taken a very different point of view. Most famously, the French philosopher of the 18th century, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Now, Rousseau believed in reincarnation and believed rather along the lines of Plato, who I talked about in a different lecture, that we come into the world after a period of revival, refreshment, or whatever, in what he called the world of forms, or heaven. And therefore, when we come into the world, we have recently been in heaven, where everything is perfect. And Rousseau argued that this is how we come into the world, that we begin as purely altruistic. We have learnt what love means, what compassion means, what sympathy means, what empathy means. And it is only as the child grows up, said Rousseau, that he or she becomes influenced by those who have been in the world longer and therefore have had a longer spell away from the perfection that is experienced in heaven. And therefore corruption, envy, greed, and so on, jealousy, and all the other qualities that bring down the standard of human life have begun to express themselves. And Rousseau therefore argued that for the first few years a child should be encouraged to discover about the world around him rather than to be pushed into society where this corruption would bring him lower. But Rousseau was quite convinced that our basic natures were altruistic, and it is only the influence of society that waters down and in some cases perhaps totally eliminates the altruistic quality which is our nature. And he begins his most famous book, Le Contrat Social, The Social Contract, with the, world-famous statement, man is born free, but everywhere he is enchaîné, in chains. Meaning by that we come into the world in a state of purity, but very quickly we get bound, tied down by these lesser ideas and forms of behaviour. Well, that is one view, but of course that takes into account or assumes a belief in reincarnation. There was a much earlier than this, and in a different country entirely, there was a Chinese philosopher of the 3rd century BCE called Mencius, sometimes called Meng Tzu, who argued the case that the natural condition of man is to be loving, compassionate, sympathetic. He argued that very strongly. And the example that he used, which to him was the final end to the argument, that no more need to be said after that, what was to do with the village square. Apparently in Chinese villages at that time, and still in many of them today, there is a well in the middle of the square, from which the village gets its water, of course. And he said, which of you, seeing a child playing on the edge of the well, and then seeing that child trip up so that he's about to fall down the well, which of you, indifferent to who the child is, it's not a question of whether it's your child or what or child you know, maybe a complete stranger, indifferent to that, which of you, he said, would not immediately leap forward to grab the child to stop him from falling down to his death? And Mencius's, those who were discussing this with him, had to agree that they would do that. Doesn't that show, said Mencius, that we are, when we get down to it, fundamentally altruistic? And he said something which really Rousseau was saying a couple of thousand years later, that it is only the corruption of society that waters down or destroys that basic altruism that is in us. So what Rousseau and Mencius, who are taking a different view from Hobbes, are saying is that our fundamental nature is to be good, whatever that word means, but to have the qualities we admire, but that these get distorted by the pressures that society brings about. Hobbes, on the other hand, argued that society, by its warped judgment on many issues, reflects the basic condition of the individuals who constitute the society. That is the difference between these two points of view. Now, before I go on to the significant implications of what Hobbes says, one must say that it's an issue one could debate for a very long time, if not forever, because you can never verify the truth of this. One could say, for example, the example of Oates was one of selfishness. One could also say it was one of pure altruism. I was reading in the newspapers of some conflict in the Middle East, when one of the, I forget which country he belonged to, but there was a tank in which a hand grenade had been thrown, and there were four men in this tank, and one of the four immediately leapt onto the hand grenade, only a split second to do so, before it exploded. Had it exploded with all four of them standing around, they would, of course, in that confined space, have been blown to pieces. What happened was that he was, of course, blown to pieces, but his body lessened the shock of the explosion enough to save the lives of his three companions. Now, I'm quite sure that Mencius would have quoted that as an example rather like the child playing by the well, that he did this absolutely according to his basic nature. Hobbes, I think, would have said that, it's hard to judge what would go through a man's mind in the split second he had in order to act. but that it was going to die anyway, so he might as well die a hero. Well, whether the three who survived looked upon him that way, I don't know. But at any rate, Hobbes remained consistent to this view. And it is tied up with his view on what we call today determinism. The fact that he didn't see individuals as basically any different from machines that respond inevitably to certain pressures from certain angles, certain directions, and behave in ways which are inevitable once one knows what has gone before, that if you press a certain button, a certain thing will happen. And human beings, he argued, were like that, that we don't have free will, we're all of us effectively machines. So that if we're going to anything we do, in fact, is caused by something else, and everything we say is caused by what has gone before. He even said that there's no such thing as a thought that comes, in the common phrase, as a bolt from the blue. There is no blue, he said, and there's no bolt. Whatever we think, which is a physical action in the brain, is caused by whatever has happened to the next door cell. I don't think he talked in terms of cells, because I don't think that had been discovered then. But he said that whatever has been going on in the brain causes this thought to occur. So at no point are we in a position to make a completely, or indeed even remotely, free choice. We are completely made by our surroundings, made by the conditions in which we are. Whether we're talking about the condition of our bodies or the condition of the world around us. Now, you may say, what's that got to do with whether we're altruistic or not? It has a great deal to do with how he applied his theory about human nature. He saw human beings then as an integral part of a mechanistic universe, naturally fundamental, naturally selfish, naturally quarrelsome, naturally power-hungry, naturally cruel, naturally perverse. And he then applied this to how society, or how particularly a nation, should be governed. Because in the state of anarchy, in any state of anarchy, and the word anarchy means that there is no government at all, in a state of anarchy, people will destroy each other. And so he sees the process of government as being one in which people are forced to compromise. And he sees government as a form of contract in which the ruler agrees to bring in laws and to oversee the administration of these laws, which prevent people from going at one another. The law to stop violence between people, for example, to stop theft between people, which can lead easily to violence. Laws which force people to accept whatever restrictions living in society alongside other people, whatever restrictions that condition requires. That is how he sees the role of the government, a contract. That the ruler will make that stipulation on his side, and on the side of the people, they accept the ruler's authority and obey the laws. And his argument was that this was how government would best be administered. And he expressed this argument in what is, I think, would be said by general agreement to be the greatest philosophy book, in this case on political philosophy, ever written in English. And it's the book Leviathan. Now that's spelt L-E-V-I-A-T-H-A-N, Leviathan. For those who are not well versed in the book of Job in the Old Testament, Leviathan was the great monster, often thought of as a whale, probably was, but it is the biggest, the hugest beast known on the planet, on the earth. And Hobbes describes the state as Leviathan, which, left to itself, will just dash everything to pieces and dash itself to pieces, I suppose. It is a monster that has somehow to be controlled. And he sees this control as coming through the rule of one individual, a monarch, or, another word is, an autocrat. Certainly not a democracy, certainly not an oligarchy, which means rule by several, or rule by many. You see, if we take Hobbes's view of human nature and apply it, well, in the situation of government, it follows that a democracy where you've got cabinet rule, I suppose, rule by a group, those who do the ruling will all have this same selfish nature. And therefore, he argued, if you've got a group of people who are governing, each of them will, deep down, even though he may not express it openly, but deep down, he will want to be the boss man. Each of them will want to be the key figure in this. So that anything that any individual says, any vote he gives, anything he supports or objects to, will inevitably have as its aim the achievement of power for this individual. And therefore he felt that, he argued, that democracy could not work. What we needed was rule by one man. And the way he saw it was that this person would be elected by the people. That's the one occasion in which the people have something to do about the process of governing or choosing the governor. They would elect the person they want to govern. And after that, the succession, as with the monarchy, would be assured. There would be no further need for any more elections. The election would simply establish the rule, or the ruler, for all time. Because we would know that normally his eldest son would take over, or his eldest daughter in modern times, I suppose, but certainly the next in line would be known, just as today with the British monarchy, we know who is next in line, and we know that if the first four in line are, for some unaccountable reason, eliminated, then number five would come in line. And they would never have to stop and think, well, who is going to be our next monarch? And this is, from Hobbes's point of view, ideal. Because if it is the case that the elected ruler does not have to worry himself about being re-elected, if he knows that he is there for life, then he can get on bringing in those acts or bills which are for the best good of the people whom he is governing. We've seen, if we were to read the history of elections in Britain over the last 20 or 30 years, how quite frequently, just before a general election, measures are brought in which are agreeable to a vast number of people. Now, the question that one has to ask is whether those measures, perhaps reducing taxes for something or whatever, whether those measures are for the best good of the people in the long run. And Hobbes foresaw that if you have elections frequently, that you would find that as the time of the election approached, the basic issue would not be whether it is for the ultimate good of the people, but whether this will help us or hinder us from being re-elected. And he saw this as meaning that the line that the ruler should take, which is always that he should rule for the welfare of all, not just in the short term, but over the long term period, that this would be likely to be lost sight of, and that therefore an ulterior, a lesser motive would dominate whatever measures were taken during the period leading up to an election. So he saw this as being for life and felt that this would lead to a more objective, a more disinterested form of government. So Hobbes stands out very much against Plato, for a start. Plato argued that in the ideal republic, it wasn't a democracy he was talking about, because not all the people were involved in governing. But it was certainly an oligarchy, but we might call it a meritocracy. It was a government by a group of people who served for a year or 2 years at the most, and then were replaced by another group, so that no one person ever got complete power. And because it was a short-term thing, nobody could look upon politics as a lifelong occupation, and B, one in which he can feather his own nest in the process. That was the alternative view to government from that of Hobbes. But Hobbes stands out as the great defender of government by one person, the person who makes the contract, that he will create the laws and see that the laws are carried out, and in return the people obey him, obey the laws. Now, I'm sure you can see what is the big problem with Hobbes here. If you could find such a person, then I suppose a strong case could be made out for that form of government. But the argument has turned right round, hasn't it? It's gone full circle. We've begun by saying that the natural condition of man is a state of war with his fellows, that we are all nasty, basically nasty, self-seeking, non-altruistic, not considering others. And he says this is the natural condition of every representative of the human race. And yet now he's putting a point of view that here is one person who is above such considerations. Now Hobbes argued that by giving so much power, so much authority, so much responsibility to one person, he would be able to rise above it. He was quite convinced that would be the case. It would be difficult, I think. My historical knowledge is not as encyclopedic as some, but I think it would be difficult to think of an example of one ruler who has ruled with total altruism. A 19th century Victorian historian by the name of Lord Acton, in one of his history treatises, made a statement which has become very famous. All power tends to corrupt. Absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And as we read the history of the world, or even think of some nations in our own time, and a lot of the African states, I have to say, would fall under this category, wherever there has been one ruler, it is difficult to think of an example of the ruler who has ruled altruistically. He may have done some things that could be interpreted altruistically, in that category, but to think of a ruler who ruled continually throughout his life without considering his own interests and thinking only of the interests of others, my feeling is you'd have to read an awful lot of history books and look far and wide in order to find one. Even in local government, you find petty dictators establishing themselves. If we take Hobbes at his word, then we can say, well, this is what you expect in rulers. Why have this idea that you're going to get some ruler who's above it all, who has risen to a higher level of human forms of behaviour, who has put aside selfishness and has established altruism as the way of ruling? Why not simply say that the ruler himself needs to be checked all the time, and people should guard against the ruler going off the rails because of his own selfish interests. Well, that's a question that anybody interested in politics should reflect on. The fact is that Hobbes remained true to this doctrine. How far he saw in Charles II at the time of the Restoration the ideal, we don't know. He wasn't really a monarchist in the sense of at that time people talked about the divine right of kings, and I don't think the word divine would occur to Hobbes. He might have had some religious ideas, but he wasn't a deeply religious man at all. And in fact, by many in his own time, he was described as an atheist. But then the word atheist in those days was used for anybody who didn't subscribe to the 39 Articles of the Church of England. So perhaps that doesn't mean a great deal. But he was certainly looked upon as not in the fold by those who were. So he's looking for a person who is given the responsibility to rule. He obviously needs his henchmen, if you like. He needs his team of people who will administer much of this, what he does. But in the end, he accepts responsibility for the ruling of the nation. Well, now let's just see what other philosophers have said in later centuries to this concept. Concept which is standing out against the idea of democracy. One philosopher whose life overlapped with Hobbes's to a certain extent, though he was younger than Hobbes, was John Locke, L-O-C-K-E, who argued that, precisely the point I've just made, that one person ruling would lead to corruption, inevitably, and that therefore we needed, he argued, a group of people, this is the beginnings of democracy, a group of people who would, between them, make sure that nobody became absolute dictator. And the first steps towards democracy in this country reflect the political ideas of this very remarkable man, John Locke, who had been a surgeon, a ship's surgeon, in fact, for some years. His main reason why he wanted to see democracy was precisely the point of being able to remove any rulers who were falling down on the job. He felt that the real frustration for the country as a whole would be if the ruler were no longer bringing in bills and measures that were for their good. That if he were, for example, simply using all that he demanded from them in taxes to reward a few of his closest friends, and it was indifferent to the interests of the many and favoured the few. And he really was arguing the case that if you cannot get rid of a corrupt regime, then the nation really will be frustrated. And this is all reflected in the American Constitution. John Locke was read by the founding fathers of the Republic, and their statement is that right from the very start, that they should be able to replace anybody who had not served the needs of the people as a whole. And the American Declaration of Independence makes that quite plain, that the rights of man must be so established that if any government falls down on the fulfillment of these rights, they should be able to be replaced by others for the good of the whole. And Locke argued that this was psychologically absolutely necessary. He thought that the condition of a nation where the ruler was completely indifferent to the needs of the vast majority and let them go to pot if he wanted to, and the thought that you could not even replace this guy because it was not in the Constitution, that would be the most dreadful state of all. So Locke argued that we must have in rule, rule by a group who would watch each other very carefully. That's on the one hand. But who could be replaced. Now, Locke was writing at the time when there were a government and an opposition developing, and you had the Whigs, who are now the Liberals, and the Tories. And these two were in opposition, and if one government should fall down in its duties, then, as we know, and we can read our history of this, at the next election, they could be replaced by the other side. And at the time of Locke, there was a general election every 7 years. Now, I think it would be wrong to think of Locke as expressing or living through a period of democracy. Got to bear in mind that in that 17th century when he was writing, and to the early 18th century, the only people who were members of Parliament were the local squires, the landowners, and the only people who had the vote were the landowners. So, although it is an advance on the idea that one person rules forever without any elections, it is still incredibly limited. Gradually, if you read your history, you'll know that gradually the franchise, the right to vote, was extended first of all to include, especially after the Industrial Revolution, when some of the wealthiest people were not landowners but factory owners, industrialists, they became added to the list of those that were allowed to vote, and then eventually householders were added, particularly houses of a certain size, and gradually it was extended over the 19th century until in 1918 it became the fact that the law that all men over 21 and women over 30, women only got the vote and they had to be 30 in 1918, and it was only in 1928, which may be in the lifetime of somebody listening to this talk, only in 1928 that women over 21 joined men in having the vote. And that was reduced from 21 to 18, I forget the date, but about 20 years ago. So, and there is arguments now that the vote should be, that the age should be further reduced. But the process whereby the franchise was extended to the whole of the nation was a long-winded process. But you could say that Locke was the thinker who began this process. The person who really continued it and made it the central platform of his political philosophy anyway, was John Stuart Mill. Now, we look at Mill in another lecture apropos of his ideas on morality, but we're not looking at that today. Mill was a 19th century academic. Well, he was a very learned man, but the point is that he was very liberal in every sense of the word. Liberal has become a word that is used, bandied about, as though there's something rather dubious about being liberal. I think it's time for this word to be brought out. The word liberal means that you listen to other people's points of view, that you don't think that because you're able, you've got a bit more clout than somebody else, therefore your opinion counts as more. That because you happen to be a newspaper proprietor and can put your ideas in 3-inch-high headlines in the paper that you own, that therefore that makes you more authoritative than the person who's thinking matters through. The fact that you could argue something is black as opposed to white, when in fact the situation is a series of shades of grey, doesn't mean that you... And because black and white stand out more starkly than grey, that doesn't mean to say that you're right. And the liberal point of view is simply saying, look, for goodness sake, there are all these people in the world, they've all got a point of view. Let us not just brush aside others' points of view. And in fact, Mill, in his book On Liberty, put this point of view of the idea of the individual in very famous words indeed. He said, if all mankind, minus one, were of one opinion, and only one person were of the contrary opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he, if he had the power, would be justified in silencing mankind. He adds a bit later, we can never be sure that the opinion we are endeavouring to stifle is false opinion. And if we were sure, stifling it would be an evil still. Well, there are some of the most marvellous words written about individual rights and responsibilities. How far we can take that, it would be a matter for great debate, and you may wish to discuss this with others afterwards. After all, if the one person is preaching, shall we say, racial intolerance, do you allow him to speak? I suspect the mill would say yes, and that the falsity of his argument would be clear to those who are listening. Others might be a little bit more uncertain about that. But in general, that is the great statement of the liberal point of view, that you shouldn't go around denying the chance to put their points of view to people who you disagree with, people who you think have got it wrong. And this is really what philosophy is about, and Hobbes in his own way was doing exactly the same, that it should be inviting everybody who has a point of view to discuss it together. Let us reason together. What Winston Churchill called jaw-jaw instead of war-war. And philosophers are motivated by the conviction that ultimately, if you reason things together, some way, some modus vivendi, some way of living together, of accepting one another despite different points of view, could be worked out. Unfortunately, in the television age, we have an age of what are known as sound bites, where the person who can give the snappiest, most ear-catching statement seems to be winning the argument. Often, an argument needs to be very carefully developed, and to look at the facts, and to see the whole scene, and that takes time. And on television, they haven't got time for that. If you see a television interview, if anybody starts a sentence that is going to be more than two lines in print, he's immediately cut off by the interviewer. Now, Mill would have seen that as a dreadful condition to be in, because it means that the reasoning powers are not given the chance to bring their force, their authority into play. We've just got these snap decisions that sound good, look good, but may well be wrong in the circumstances. Now, looking at Mill, Mill was really, more than Locke, the great proponent of democracy. He wanted a situation in which the vote should certainly be extended. He was himself for two or three years a member of Parliament. He got very bored with Parliament, gave it up and went to grow vines in Avignon in France, where he spent his final years. Some might say a very wise man indeed, but he did spend some time in Westminster, and during that time he became the first man ever to speak in favour, A, of women having the vote, and B, of women being members of Parliament. And the Punch magazine, which was really quite well read in Victorian times, did a whole lot of cartoons showing the House of Commons, as Mr. Mill would like it, and it shows a front row of women all knitting away, and of Mill being escorted into the House by two women, each of them about a foot and a half taller than him, showing him where, putting him in his place. Well, that was the attitude of the time. Mill stood out against it, and he is really the father of democracy as we now know it. Except that, we come back to Hobbes now. How far are we in democracy? How far have we got it? Democracy defined by President Lincoln, the greatest president that America has produced, with the possible exception of Franklin D. Roosevelt, well, that would be a matter for an interesting debate. Abe Lincoln described democracy in his famous Gettysburg Address as government of the people, for the people, by the people. Of, for, by. Well, nobody's doubting that it's government of the people. If you reflect on the governments you have known in your lifetime, how far do you consider them to be for the people? That would be a matter of debate. What is really the real question mark is how far it is government by the people. Now, Hobbes was quite certain that the people should not be allowed to govern. If all the people are in this state of war against each other, the idea of the people governing was completely alien to his thinking altogether. even in where we have, and we have got a bureaucracy, every single person, apart from one or two very small groups, such as members of the House of Lords and lunatics, and I think members of the Church of England, haven't got the right to vote. Or prisoners. No, they do have a right to vote in the Church of England. They're not allowed to be MPs as vicars of the Church of England. Almost everybody's got the right to vote. Surely we might say we therefore got democracy. Well, if you talk to people generally, I suspect you would find that this is not as easily agreed on as one might anticipate. What does democracy mean? We have a vote every 5 years is the maximum we can go to now, averaging out about every 4 years over the last 20 or 30 years or so. So every 4 years we put our cross on a ballot paper. How many people who put the cross on the ballot paper really know what they're talking about or voting on? How many people really know? How many of you have at a general election read through the manifestos of the different parties, ponder on these manifestos, think through which are the best policies in your opinion, and then vote accordingly? How many people really know? The problem with democracy, of course, is that it allows not only those who know a little bit about what these, about economics, shall we say, and about the process of governing, but it also allows people who know absolutely nothing about this, never read a newspaper except to read the racing results, only watch quizzes on television and wouldn't know a Conservative from a Labour and wouldn't know the difference anyway. I'm not sneering at these people. They may well be wiser than the rest of us who do worry a bit about politics. But the fact is that their vote counts just as much as one who's spent a week looking at the different manifestos. Now, Mill himself recognised this, and he, now you'll say this is anti-democratic, but he said a person who's got a degree at either Oxford or Cambridge should have two votes. And until 1951 was the last year when Oxford University and Cambridge University did not have their own MP. So that a person living in either Oxford or Cambridge, well, it didn't matter where he lived actually, but he would have a vote in his own constituency for the constituency MP, but he would have a second vote for the university. As it happens, they invariably returned independent members, not of the political parties. But it did reflect a little bit of Mill's exalting the intellect, and he felt that this should show that if you've got a degree at those exalted universities, then you should have a vote for those like yourself who've got degrees. And all people with degrees at those universities until 1951 had this second vote. Well, I think our view today would be, well, we mustn't make such a value judgment. We cannot go on saying that only the intelligent should be allowed this extra vote, or indeed that only the intelligent should be allowed to vote. By opening up the doors to democracy, it means that we give the vote to those who haven't the slightest idea. And having been a parliamentary candidate myself, I can assure you that the arguments you get, why people are not going to vote for you, or why people are going to vote for you, are absolutely flabbergasting. That people think the strangest reasons that people give for going one way or the other, nothing to do with the issues which, according to the manifestos of the parties, are actually the ones that are being voted on during the campaign. But that is democracy. Winston Churchill said of democracy, "It is the worst system of government in the world, except for all the rest." And maybe the point we're making is that government is itself going to be not only terribly difficult, but it's going to bring out the worst in those who govern, which again is coming back to Hobbes's point that we are all motivated by self-interest, so that when any party, even in a democracy, gets elected to power, it begins to use, and inevitably begins to use, that power in some ways for its own advantage. And we've seen over the last government and the present government how what they call sleaze has come in, and people have been trying to line their pockets in different ways. Hobbes wouldn't have been in the slightest degree surprised about that. He'd have said, what do you expect? You've given this person a position of responsibility and a certain amount of power. He's obviously going to use that power in order to bring some advantage to himself. He'd have just thrown up his hands against those who express shock, horror about sleaze. It is inevitable, he says. Bernard Shaw said that the difference between democracy and autocracy is that in democracy you have the ignorant many, and in autocracy you have appointment by the corrupt few. Well, that's a typical Shavian Bernard Shaw remark, but he's really, I think, pointing out that we must not be looking for perfect saints to do the governing. After all, the people who do the governing are people like ourselves, and there'll be some who are a bit more considerate of the people at large than others. There'll be some who will be less concerned about feathering their own nests than others. They'll have a mixture, and that is how democracy should be. Well, the final question I'd simply put to you is this: if we're really going to get a democracy, then don't we need to feel that the vast numbers who are effectively disenfranchised, that is to say, the numbers in a particular constituency who might in their thousands have voted for one particular party, but that party has never won in that constituency, should have some feel that they are being represented according to the number of votes that are cast. In other words, that we shouldn't have some form of proportional representation. I suspect that if Hobbes had to come to terms with democracy, that he would have felt that this is probably the best way of doing it. It's the most certain way of ensuring that you don't allow the selfish side to come in, i.e. that a party that gets 50% of the votes overall should have perhaps three-quarters of the members of Parliament, or that a party, even worse, a party that only gets 40% of the votes overall, should therefore then have enough, because of the split in the others, to form the government, and that you would have a government in which the number of members of each party would reflect the numbers in that had actually done the voting. If that were the case, of course, then at the moment, and I'm recording this now in the year 2001, at the moment you would have President Gore in the United States and not President Bush, who got in, I think one could say, without being libelous, in Churchill's own phrase, as a result of appointment by the corrupt few. We would not have had governments as we've had them over the past, well, in my lifetime. We would have a mixture. The problem with PR, of course, is that the probability is that you would never have any one party who had enough members to form a government on their own. So you would always have to have a compromise between two of these parties, which means that you would then, in the final policies, not have any of the manifestos as they're presented to the people being put into acts in Parliament. Well, that may be a price we have to pay. Well, just to go back then finally to the great Hobbes himself, I don't think you can discount him. I think that whenever you're looking at human beings, you've got to bear in mind what he said and think that it is quite likely that this human being will be guided by ulterior motives. My own reaction in the end is this. To begin with, when I first heard Hobbes being taught, when I studied philosophy donkeys years ago, I was horrified by this idea that everything we do is motivated by self-interest. I've now come round to the view that even if Hobbes is right, and as I said, we can't verify this, even if Hobbes is right, once we accept that people are guided by self-interest, does it really matter? As long as you know this, you know that we're not going to let them get away with everything they want to get away with. That we're all in a position, therefore, of putting checks and brakes on each other to prevent anybody from going over the top in his attempt to achieve his own self-interest. My own view is that if we can get to that, then far from seeing Hobbes as a villain, we can see him as one who's really shown us, in many respects, how we should live alongside.